It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to Really with Tom and Dave. I'm Dave, and I'll just let you figure out who Tom is. And we have a great show for you this week.
Very exciting show. I mean, it's difficult to overstate Leslie Kane's impact on the UFO UAP conversation. Her 2017 New York Times article is widely seen as a threshold moment, one that forced the government to perhaps begrudgingly admit that there is something in our skies, among other things. But as an investigative journalist, she's been published nationally and internationally in the Boston Globe, The Nation, and the International Herald Tribune, to name a few, and is the co-founder of the Coalition for Freedom of Information. Her book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, was a New York Times bestseller, and her extraordinary book, Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for the Afterlife, is now a Netflix documentary. That topic is multiple podcasts on its own. She's also the executive producer of UFOs Investigating the Unknown, which is now available on Hulu, and we're super grateful and excited to speak with her today on Really. Now, a note,
yes,
Dave,
we're
about
in a
our
different
set.
Location this
yeah,
week.
Where are we? Why are we in this undisclosed location?
Well, we are at our very good friend Evan Schletter's studio in Hollywood because there is a writer's strike currently in progress, and we normally record our shows over at the CBS Radford Studios, but there is a pickup line outside of those studios for good reason.
That we will not cross.
Mm-hmm. So we will not cross that line, so we are here today. And until the strike ends.
So forgive any technical difficulties, of which there will be none. Everyone has worked wonderfully hard to create this wonderful space for us. But yes, that's why we are here.
All right. And so with that, I guess
let's talk to Leslie.
Let's talk to Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Leslie. Good to see you again. Thank you so much for doing this. I believe you've been on a few podcasts.
I think I have been on two.
Yeah, is it in the thousands yet?
Rodeo, yeah.
I don't keep count, but yeah. There's a lot that I don't go on because I can't, otherwise I would do them all day long and I can't do that.
Well,
so
then we
I'm happy to be with you guys.
Yeah, we're super grateful.
Thanks for being you. And I'd say one of the things, I mean, if we have a niche at all, one of the things what we're trying to do is sort of look at how people make the transition from being maybe not at all curious to being a little curious to learning about being startled by the UFO story and then maybe coming to kind of acceptance of it. And you certainly, I think, went through that quite a while ago, as I understand
yeah.
it. Like, because you didn't come straight out of journalism school. They have those, right? Journalism schools. Those things happen.
Yeah.
You didn't come straight out of that thing and go, hey, I got to get on this UFO beat as soon as I can. Because you were working in public radio, I think.
In public radio, yeah. And I got my training by really doing. I mean, I was mentored by a journalist, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I never went to formal journalism school, but I did a lot of, wrote articles with this journalist who was mentoring me and learned a lot just by doing it, by writing stories, by getting them published. And I did a lot of radio reporting, too. Mm-hmm. So that was basically my training.
And so what sort of stuff were you reporting on when you first became a journalist?
Well, what happened was I was very interested in the struggle for democracy in Burma, because I had a close friend who had been a monk in Burma, and then he went into the jungles, and there are horrific things going on in that country. But it also had this very high-minded kind of Buddhist philosophy that permeated the culture, which was incredibly, you know, just beautiful. I mean, you'd never seen that before, because it was integrated into how the democracy movement was running their own government. And the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi had been put under house arrest. So I was, you know, she was like this heroic figure that everybody in Burma absolutely loved. So it was this very dramatic situation. And I went over there in 96 for a few months with this person who had been a monk before, and got a lot of really interesting interviews and documentation about what was going on there, and spent a lot of time interviewing former political prisoners, spent time with Aung San Suu Kyi and her colleagues. And it was just a life-changing experience. So then when I went back to California, where I was living in the Bay Area, I met one of these reporters from KPFA Radio, which is a public radio station there. And he interviewed me on his show about Burma. And then we developed a friendship. And then I ended up working on that very show that I was interviewed for. That's how I kind of made my entree into KPFA. And to answer your question about what I was reporting on, everything. I mean, basically, it was a drive time, 5 p.m. popular news magazine show. And so just a lot of topics, mostly progressive type topics, like human rights issues and social justice, struggles of indigenous peoples, a lot of kind of giving the microphone to the people who don't normally get a microphone, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just been there for a few years covering a whole lot of different topics, and that was my job.
It's interesting you say about people who don't get the microphone. I'm just, you know, in terms of, is that a corollary in your mind of the pivot to something like the UAP UFO conversation?
I mean, the only corollary I think I would see to the work I did there, because it was very focused on people like suffering from human rights abuses, say, I consider the way some of the witnesses are treated by the culture or even by their own departments in which they work as being a kind of a human rights violation, you know, that there, I mean, when you look, especially over in the past, not as much since 2017, but, you know, the ridicule that they were subjected to, they'd have medical issues that wouldn't be dealt with. They didn't feel like they could talk to anybody. They couldn't report what happened to them. They had to live with this very, some often traumatic experience and couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, that's a kind of abuse as I see it. So in that sense, I feel like I've always been motivated. Part of my motivation has always been to serve the witnesses and all the people involved with the phenomenon who feel they can't speak out. You know, it's just not fair. It's not right. And they deserve to be heard and respected. And so whenever there's ridicule being dealt out, I just get very angry. And I think that's connected to the work I was doing at KPFA. But the topic is so different that I don't know about every and in any other way, if it's really connected.
Well, definitely. I think you're quite right. I mean, there's definitely a lot of people are traumatized by their experiences, and then they're re-traumatized by the stigmatization. And, you know, people literally do have their lives and their careers destroyed.
And they become isolated. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And they become isolated, and, you know, and it can radically change their lives. So
yeah,
that's
so there's,
terrible.
So that same element, at least, of empathy that brought you to Burma, that empathy sort of also brings you to wanting to care about the individuals, the human stories involved in the UFO experience.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's an interesting connection. I haven't thought about that very much. So thank you for making me think about it.
Yeah, that's all right. That's part of our job, I guess.
I do think it's true.
Then you did sort of hit a turning point when you came across a story that drew you into the UFO field, as I understand, which was the release of the Comet report. Was that the first thing that really drew your attention to UFOs?
Yes. I mean, I'd been curious about them prior to that, and I'd read some books on UFOs. Like, I read Communion by Willy Strieber when it came out. And I remember staying up all night and being terrified and everything reading it. But, you know, it was just a passing interest like any average person might have. You know what I mean? So nothing that I never, ever thought I would ever do anything professionally with UFOs. It was just a curiosity. So when this, it was actually a report, not a story, but this report that arrived at my desk one day in 1989. I guess it was in 1999, sorry, from France. And that's the report you just referred to. That's what really changed everything for me. It was like a light bulb moment. It was like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
And that report, to say very briefly, was written by former generals and admirals and police chiefs from France, scientists. They were all retired. They were part of a think tank that advised the government. They weren't part of the government officially. So they wrote this paper. They did a 90-page study that took 3 years, interviewing lots of pilots and looking at official data on UFO cases from around the world. And they drew the conclusion that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most valid, rational, and logical explanation for the cases they studied, because they could rule out, they had so much good data for these cases that they could rule out conventional explanations, and they were kind of left with that. And so when I saw that, like, what, you know, generals are telling me we're very likely being visited by extraterrestrials. I mean, they couldn't prove it, and they said that, but they thought it was rational and valid to consider that. And what else could it be? Mm-hmm. And so my journalist bulb went off, and I thought, this is a huge story. Are you kidding? You know? And so that's what, I mean, I was thinking, like, what if the equivalent officials in America had said that, right? That sort of happened now, but, you know, we're talking 23 years ago. I just thought it was a really big deal, and that they had done this really impressive study of all this data. So that's what led me to it. And I received that report in the fall of 99. And then in the spring of 2000, I published a story in the Boston Globe based on that report. And that was the first story I did on UFOs. And it was very difficult to get it published. It was so taboo in those days. I mean, we live in a different world now, but it was so taboo and so difficult for this editor to feel comfortable with the story, even though we were talking about generals and admirals, you know? So that's was like, once I had done that and the response was so positive to it, I was no going back. I was completely hooked by the topic. I didn't want to do anything else.
I was curious what the response of the French government was to the Cometa report. I mean, is there a different attitude in France versus the States? I'm just, this relates just kind of overall to the response, but I'm just curious, what was there? Did they have an official reaction to it?
I don't think they actually put one out. Like, the president didn't say, I think some high level officials commented on the UFO topic as a result of that report, as I recall. But the thing about France is it already had an official government agency called GEPAN that had been studying UFOs for a long time. So it was already kind of way ahead of the United States on that level. I mean, it had an official agency. It was open to the public. They made their data public. And so I think, you know, it was sort of a parallel. This was not a report issued by that agency, but it sort of paralleled it. I think one of the former heads of that agency was one of the people who wrote the white paper. So it was very well connected to that. And they just had a level of openness in France that we didn't have here at the time. So it was well received, and it was put into, like, published in a book that you could buy in France.
Well, I actually do remember reading your reporting on it back at that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I remember reading about that was one of the things that got me. As I said, I've had certain peaks and troughs in my interest in UFOs over the years, and definitely one of the peaks was when the Cometa report got reported on in the U.S.
That's cool.
Which, you know, I'd say two peaks for me were the Phoenix Lights and then the Cometa report coming out were ones where I went, okay, this isn't just a curiosity. This is something that should be taken seriously. With this level of study being done on it,
absolutely, so, I'm glad that effect. Yeah, I that's what I felt when I wrote the story, and then all these pilots started contacting me, and saying, I've never been able to tell anybody about my sighting, but I like to hear, I saw something on such and such a date, you know. It was like, I mean, and then I had to learn about this taboo and this ridicule that was out there. And I didn't understand, like, why it's so irrational. Like, what is going on here? Why aren't people more interested in this? No. Why are they just pretending it doesn't even exist? All of those things. Yeah.
Do you think that is, because Dave and I have had this conversation, do you think that is a function of an organized effort by the government from early days to socially engineer a response so that we are predisposed to dismiss it? Because you, I mean, we've talked about this at some length, that's, that there was a conscious effort through these various programs to sort of just psychologically push that subject to a place where that will be our instant kind of response. I mean, is, do you feel like that's what you're pushing up against?
Yeah, I think it in the 50s especially was when it sort of got rolling, you know. And I think it was, I mean, officially, because, you know, we know about I don't know if your readers know about the CIA meeting, the Robertson panel that met, I think it was 52 or 53. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a CIA meeting in which they actually published a document saying we've got to use ridicule to tone this thing down. It was in black and white. We've got to debunk it. You know, I mean, I won't get, you know, I could talk about that for half an hour, but that's just the essence of it. And that report was sent around all over to all the government agencies. It wasn't made public, of course. And yeah. Then Project Blue Book, of course, was, you know, just dismissing cases and making up ridiculous explanations for cases. Everybody trying to tone it down because it was during the Cold War. And ridicule was one of the tools for that, to make people not want to engage.
Yeah, and they specifically, in the Robertson report, I think they, the panel committee or whatever they're called, that they talked about how they needed to bring the mass media into the program, is make, you know, sort of recruit them, whether they know it or not, into ridiculing and debunking. You know, so I was saying, as a comedian, I feel a certain responsibility to redress that.
Yeah,
you know, because comedians played a big role.
It's really, really shocking. Yeah, and they talked about making documentaries, mass media, using mass media in all different ways, commercials, making documentaries that might, you know, serve their purpose. Infiltrating civilian groups was another thing. Mm-hmm. So, and then, yeah, I don't know if you all remember the Walter Cronkite special. I don't know, was it in 68? You know, the UFOs, what was it called? I just don't remember. See, these are the things, like, when I get in a podcast, yeah, I never know what's going to come up.
No, I know, yeah.
My brain.
Well, sorry, you don't have to be encyclopedic on this.
I know. It was influenced by the Robertson panel, though, because one of the Robertson panel members was actually part of that show and was on it. Mm-hmm. And there was a letter that was received through the Freedom of Information Act, written by one of the panel members to another, saying, yes, we were able to achieve what we wanted, you know, using the Walter Cronkite opportunity to try to get their ideas across. So it definitely had a big effect. Well, and it was kind of engineered, you know, and then it's culture. And like, we're left with the legacy of that decade after decade. It just sort of perpetuates.
I think a lot of people now think the stigma about UFOs was something that just naturally occurred because it's crazy, and that it wasn't a deliberately engineered thing, because there were kind of two eras. There was the era before the Robertson panel and after. And before that, there was mainstream media coverage, like Look magazine, Life magazine. They all did huge articles saying UFOs seemed to be real before that period. And then after that period.
They did them after, too. They did them after. Look and Life did things after that, too. I mean, there are things that keep coming out, good books and stuff, but nonetheless.
But if you can get the most trusted man in America, who I've only seen sort of his summation at the end of that special, where he basically says it's all nonsense.
So it was shocking.
Yeah, if you can get the most trusted man in America to go out and just serve your ends, it's pretty effective.
Well, it seems like, thanks in large part to your efforts over the past, I guess, two decades of getting, you know, starting with the reporting on the Cometa report and then subsequently the 2017 story, which really does seem like a threshold moment for this entire conversation. Our approach here is really one of, well, our assumption, and I feel like it's an accurate one even publicly, is there is something here. This is not a question of, is it, are they seeing things? Like, no, the settled question seems to, is they are here. There is something going on, and you don't presume to know what it is. You don't, you report from these, incredibly impeccable sources, who have trained observers. You're just telling what they see. But once you've read this, it's very hard to go back and listen to the, kind of flimsy, okay, well, it was an atmospheric, it was a light, it was a swamp gas. I mean, these sort of flimsy excuses. So I'm curious, because 2017 was so pivotal, that's kind of where I really re-woke up to it. I, like you, communion was huge for me, had some early childhood experiences that probably opened my mind to the possibilities of this type of phenomenon. But it was really like, holy smokes, like, so this is, it's in the Times, this is being reported. They are funding this. They're not telling us everything. And then it seems like some level of confirmation of, grudging admittance from the military that, okay, yeah, that is a real thing in space, if it's the Tic Tac video or that kind of thing. So I was wondering, I'm just very curious what those days were like for you in 2017, as this story was coming together. Of course, I have these kind of like Watergate, parking lot conversations in my mind that were, the deep throat cigarettes being smoked, whatever it was. But I'm curious what the actual, was it a long time developing, or did it fall in your lap, this footage? Walk us through that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, the way it all happened was, it was actually now Chris Mellon who has come out. Before he was off the record about it, but he has now talked about it. So Luis Elizondo was the head of this program at the Department of Defense called ATIP, right? Which I'm sure you and your mm-hmm. listeners are probably familiar with, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And nobody knew that program even existed. And so he was resigning in October of 2016 from that job. And he thought he could accomplish more on the outside than he could on the inside, because they weren't providing resources for him to do what he felt needed to be done to deal with this topic and this issue with UFOs. He couldn't get any information to the Secretary of Defense. He couldn't get the job done. So he decided to resign and work on the outside. And so as part of that process, they invited me, Chris and some other colleagues of his invited me to a meeting with Lou. It was, I believe, the day after he resigned. It was either the day of or the day after. It was right at that time. And I went down to Washington and spent about 3 hours with him and with Jim Sayan, Hal Puthoff, and Chris Mellon. They were all there. And I had my mind blown. I had my mind blown at that meeting. I mean, I was shown.
Can you give us just a little background?
Everything about the program.
Can you give us just a little background on who those other participants are? Because I know, like, Hal Puthoff and Jim Semivan, for people who might not have heard of those guys.
Sure. I mean, Hal Puthoff is a physicist, theoretical physicist, who's been deeply involved with this topic for decades. He used to work with remote viewing for the government. And way, way back, the SRI, when they were doing all these studies of remote viewing and psychic abilities with various people. And then he's been involved with UFOs. I mean, he's a true insider who knows a lot. And I've known him for probably 15 years or something like that. And then Jim Semivan, I don't think I'd met him in person prior to that meeting. He's a former high-level CIA official who had also, he was retired at the time, but he was very involved with the topic as well. And they were starting a group called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, which Lou was joining after he resigned from the Pentagon. They were all forming this group, which I had already written an article about prior to this, but it wasn't getting a lot of traction.
So they were all at this meeting.
And Chris Mellon. Yeah, and Chris Mellon was a former Secretary of Defense. Undersecretary of Defense, I believe, for intelligence, who was, a government official who had helped Lou and worked with Lou and helped Lou kind of make his transition from that job to coming out. And he still is working behind the scenes really hard. And he's responsible for a lot of the good things that have happened in the last 6 years. So anyway, He was the one that actually invited me to the meeting. I mean, they obviously all agreed to it, but, and I just sat there across the table from Lou for 3 hours and looked him in the eye and got to hear, got to know him, got to talk to him, ask him any questions I wanted. I was shown, you know, all the interesting documentation that has since dribbled out, but not, it had never seen the light of day at the time. Was learned about Harry Reid's involvement in the program, which was a crucial element. Was seen a document, a letter that he had written requesting special access status for the program, which I think has since been released. Performance reviews that, you know, gave Lou the highest level of ratings when he was in his job. And then I was shown those three videos. Lou didn't show them to me. Hal did. We sat down at a computer and just looked at those videos. And so for me, after, you know, after 17 years of reporting on this, and as you know, in my book, I was advocating that there be a government agency to study this. Mm-hmm. It wasn't exactly the type of agency that they had that I was hoping it would be. I was hoping it would be more out in the public, but nonetheless, for me to learn that there was one and to be shown the proof of that and to meet the people involved and be able to report, so, you know, it was just a major event for me as a journalist after all those years, you know, to suddenly be handed. And it was kind of like it was handed to me in a way. I mean, they just knew me and trusted me. So they wanted to get the story out and they knew I had a connection to the New York Times. And so it seemed like the natural way for them to go. So I went after that meeting. I went to my colleague, Ralph Blumenthal, who was a freelancer for the New York Times. At that point, I wasn't connected to the New York Times except through Ralph. And so together we pitched the story to them. And we had an actual in-person meeting with their director of investigations from the Washington Bureau at the Times when he came up to New York and showed him, you know, at that point I was able to show him everything. And so I didn't walk away from the meeting with any documents, but I was eventually given them so I could show them to this editor at the Times. And they said, well, we'll let you know. And he went back to Washington and we got the call, go for it, do it. And that's when they assigned Helene Cooper to work with us, who was their national security reporter, an unbelievably highly respected reporter on the Times who knows everybody in the Department of Defense and covers, you know, all defense related issues. So we were absolutely so fortunate to work with her and have her name on the story. And they recognized that it was a big story. They were smart enough to see that. So that's how it all happened. And then it took about 2 months, maybe a month and a half from the time we got the green light until we actually came out, maybe a month and a half. Mm. And a lot of it hinged on getting Harry Reid on the record to say, yes, I did arrange for the funding for the program. Yes, the program does exist. I'm behind it. I helped set it up. I supported it. I got the funds. And we had no idea if he would ever acknowledge any of that, you know. So Helene flew out to Las Vegas and met with him in person. And he told us everything. And so we were just elated after that meeting.
Yeah.
And how long did it take to get the green light from the first time, from when you presented the materials to the New York Times to get the green light to pursue the story? How long did that take?
I would say from the time we sat down with Mark Mazzetti, who was the, you know, in person. I mean, we had pitched the story earlier. Then the next step was to meet with him. I'd say from the time we gave all the, showed him all the stuff, and then we got the call, it was about a week, mm-hmm. I think, from when he went back to the Bureau. No more than that.
And
no
then,
more than it might have been 5.
And then the procedure to get the article written and then through the editorial staff at the New York Times, what was that like?
That was about a month and a half. It's intense. I mean, dealing with the editors is very difficult at the Times. They have a lot of control. They scrutinize every single thing. They will tell you have to do certain things. Like we had to put some skeptics or debunkers in there to say things that really had nothing to do with the story. Mm. You know, it was just nothing to do with it. But they said, well, you've got to have some skeptics.
Right. Find somebody who doesn't believe it and give them time. Yeah, that's frustrating, but.
Exactly. You know, things like that. We wanted to say certain things that they wouldn't let us say. I mean, you have to pick your battles with the editors. You have to really fight for certain things and you got to let go of other things. So, but basically they were real. I mean, they're also very good editors. I mean, I'm not complaining. They're very good editors. They know, you know, they know how to do their job and it benefits the writers to have the good editing. But it's also a kind of a push-pull thing, and it can take a while to go through that process.
Yeah, I'm asked mostly because I think there's kind of an absurd notion circulating among sort of the debunking community or the skeptical community that the media are diving into this story because they see it as a big moneymaker. That, you know, the idea that the media, like the New York Times, is uncritically digesting all of this and disseminating it because they think it's a huge popularity grab. And it seems like that's the exact opposite of your experience.
I would say so. I mean, they're nervous. They, you know, covering UFOs, that's sort of a going out on a limb for them, right? I don't think they had any idea how big this first story would be at the Times. And then if they were doing it for money, then why aren't they doing it a lot more than they do, right? They don't do it very often. When they do, they have a skeptical reporter, Julian Barnes, is now the one covering it. So I really don't think, I mean.
Yeah, it seems like the New York Times has done everything in their power to undermine the initial reporting since you guys released.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to comment on that, but.
I will.
That's your opinion. You know, we have done a series of stories since that first one.
Yes.
But not so much recently.
Mm-hmm. It makes me curious how you feel about the current state of the conversation, because we have sort of two interesting recent examples of the conversation. One, you have Kirkpatrick, the head of Arrow, and for those, you know, who it's the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, which is largely exists because of your work and the work of Chris Mellon and the fact that this became such a big topic of conversation that it seems like they were almost forced to acknowledge it. And there's been senators now supporting this endeavor, and there seems to be almost bipartisan support for this endeavor, even though there's pushback. But he was quoted, I think, in his kind of big anticipated sort of talk this hearing, to say that he hadn't seen, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but he hadn't seen anything that went outside the laws of physics that we could explain, and sort of threw this like wet blanket on the situation. So you have sort of that, which was kind of like, oh, got a bit of a buzzkill, and that's disappointing. And who's this Kirkpatrick guy? And then you have Gary Nolan, who we've had a chance to speak with, and of course is the professor of pathology at Stanford, very respected, big ally of this conversation, and who, you know, just a few days ago was like, 100% they're here. There's reverse engineering programs, absolutely. It's all, they've been here for a very long time. And so we have represents this, I want to say, just the current, there's people like yourself and Gary Nolan with this credibility that is outside of the kind of, you know, that are data people, research interested in that kind of thing. So I'm just curious. It feels like a digging in of heels on both sides. I'm just sort of curious how you would characterize where we are. What's the state of the conversation right now?
I mean, I think the digging in of heels that you described is really with the Arrow with the Department of Defense, because that hearing was disappointing to many people. Like you just pointed out that I think he was probably not being very, very forthcoming. I think he knows more than he was willing to say. I mean, and people weren't happy with that for good reason. So that's the Department of Defense side, but then it's the Congress that's really been the one that's pushing this forward. And they are demanding more from Arrow. They're demanding certain things from Arrow. They're asking Arrow to step up to the plate and to deliver documents to them and reports on who they interview and all this. And so I think the push-pull you're describing is between the Congress and the Department of Defense, basically. So we have to take our hats off to Congress for passing legislation that is making these things happen. I mean, 2 years in a row, the NDAA had these big sections covering the UAP topic. It's just, you know, astonishing when you think about it, that that's happened. And that they were the ones that demanded that Arrow be set up. But they're also, Congress is also getting their own reports from whistleblowers and others who want to just give them information. It's not all going to Arrow.
Yeah.
So
I assume you probably have sources who have spoken to Arrow that and to Senate and congressional members. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling there's a frustration that, that people keep bringing information to Arrow and that it doesn't seem to be taken seriously or investigated. And I know for me, I thought something very strange about that hearing was that as he's trying to basically deflect almost, you know, the whole story, he also shows a video that seems to show an object defying the laws of physics. And there's been almost no follow-up on it. They show this sphere that has no visible means of lift, no control surfaces, nothing. Just a sphere flying through a combat zone, apparently in violation of the laws of physics, because we don't know how you make anything shaped like that fly. And there was no follow-up in that hearing. Like, Christian Gillibrand didn't ask any questions. He showed it and said it's an unexplained. But no one said, well, tell us why it's unexplained. Explain what you can't explain about this. And there's been no media follow-up on that. He showed this thing that's inexplicable. No.
But he also gave the impression that he thinks he's going to be able to come up with explanations for just about every case there is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he would have said, well, we still have to study this video. We don't know if we don't know what it is. I mean, he's very much oriented towards solving every anomaly. Mm-hmm. Didn't you get that feeling that he seems to think that that's going to be the ultimate result of, I mean, it's not going to be, but that's his goal. So I don't know if he would ever acknowledge, I don't know how much he would acknowledge. It's a really interesting point though, that you're making. Yeah.
How do you show that and then not address it?
Well, I feel like the trick is in the name, right? Because I actually wrote it down wrong. I had written down the All Domain Anomaly Research Office, and that's not what it is. It's the Resolution Office. Like, I feel like it speaks to what you're saying, which is like, we're going to – and he was very clear about, like, we just want to get everybody together, and then we want to hand it off to all the different agencies. Like, he seemed just – his mission was to get this off his plate as quickly and cleanly as possible, because I will make sure everybody's plugged into everybody else, and did not seem to be it always makes me kind of the question that always is in my brain is like, who's the bad guy? We know government is not monolithic. The Congress does seem more sympathetic towards this issue than it has been in my lifetime. At the same time, we have this fellow who I don't know from Adam, but he seems to be in charge of a program that he doesn't seem crazy about, or he seems to be dubious of. So you know many more of these people in the inside government, and is there a villain? Is there someone we can just point at and be like, they're the problem? Is it the Air Force? How would you describe the pushback? Is it legacy programs that no one can kind of sneak into, or I guess who's pushing back on Sidney Kirkpatrick when Congress is pushing him from the front to be more forthcoming?
I don't know. I mean, Sean Kirkpatrick.
Sean, my bad.
That's to make that clear.
Sorry.
Okay. No, I mean, I don't think it's any one. First of all, I think Sean Kirkpatrick is probably part of the pushback world. Right, himself. He doesn't need anybody to push back on him. He's already doing that anyway. I mean, that's where he comes from. That's his position on this, you know. So I think a lot of people consider him to be part of that, one of the main forces of that, really. And, you know, I think it comes from a lot of different places, and it's very subtle. And you can't really say, well, it's one, like you pointed out, it's not one agency or one group of people or one, you know, anything you can really necessarily put your fingers on. But, you know, whistleblowers who might try to come forward, some of them have faced repercussions for doing that, and they don't always even know where it's coming from. Sometimes they do know. It could be coming from the agency that they're working in.
Well, even,
you know, the company they work for doesn't want someone to be people to talk about this. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like like Lou Elizondo has gone through waves of people trying to discredit him since he's come forward in 2000.
But that's been more the UFO community than it's been anybody really. I think it's more the UFO community, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, I know he also had within the Department of Defense people claiming that he had no affiliation with ATIP. If he was involved with ATIP, he certainly wasn't in a high ranking position. And I know Harry Reid came out and very forcefully defended him. But it does seem like
they had to retract those statements.
But it does seem like maybe is the do you think maybe the push in the UFO community to discredit Lewis? Obviously, there's that inbuilt paranoia about the military and intelligence operatives in the UFO community. But do you think there's also maybe it's being directed from within the Department of Defense that there's?
I don't think what goes on in the UFO community. No, I don't. I just don't believe that. That the what's goes on. I think the UFO community is kind of in its own bubble world. I don't think that the. I mean, there may be trolls and people that infiltrate the Twitterverse to kind of, you know, there could be on that. I mean, on that level. I mean, I really, you know, I'm not in a position to know, because if it's all undercover, then I'm not going to be in a position to know what's happening, you know, undercover. But there are just elements out there that don't want this to come out. And they all do whatever they can do within their own pathways, you know, to influence it. And there are plenty of elements that do want it to come out too. So I think we have, you know, it's moving in the direction of coming out. I mean, there's no question that the forward motion is what's winning here. I wouldn't, you know, and the Congress has played a big role in making that happen, and it is bipartisan. It's really
which I haven't seen a lot of in a long time.
Pretty encouraged about it.
Yeah. You know, that's good. I'm happy to hear you're encouraged.
Exactly,
about it.
It's probably the only thing.
Yeah, at least since pre-Obama days.
I mean, if you look back from 2016.
Since, the pre-Obama days, there hasn't been much bipartisan legislation of any sort on any subject. And suddenly we do have pretty much unanimous bipartisan legislature being written by, you know, Kristen Gillibrand and Tim Burchett should not be allies on anything. But they are in this story, you know.
Exactly. It's true. And it's wonderful to see that. And it makes sense, because this is an issue that almost transcends the normal human issues that we deal with every day. It's why should, you know, where is the partisan aspect of this? I don't think there really is one. So it's kind of a universal thing, right? And it's a national security issue. So I think it works, and I'm glad for that. But I just think if you have to look back from where we were before 2017 and compare it to where we are now, and then you really could see how far we've come. I mean, it's phenomenal to me, especially after having been around this for 17 years prior to that.
Yes.
Well, I get seeing the difference.
Reminds me of something I wanted to ask you, which is like when you were first looking into the subject, were you aware of George Knapp at that point?
Oh, yeah. And I remember watching his series he did. I forget what it was called. You know, it was
Best Evidence
TV series he did about UFO
UFO's
evidence.
Best Evidence.
It was called UFO Evidence or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, UFO's Best Evidence. Oh, yeah, I was definitely very impacted by him and learned a lot from him.
But was it in any way a cautionary tale, though? Because George, who was a pretty serious journalist in Vegas at the time when he did the Lazar story, became that UFO guy for the rest of his career. Did you see that happening? Did you see that in his career and go, maybe I don't want that in mine?
Well, I was more, I don't think I really cared if it was in my, because that's what I was doing. And so I wasn't going to hide it, you know, and I didn't want to cover anything else. So, I mean, yeah, what else could I, you know, it would be a fair thing to say that I was a reporter who covered UFOs, but I was also extremely careful and I think more conservative perhaps than George in terms of what I covered. And I was writing for mainstream news. I mean, his focus was his Las Vegas station, so it was more local, but I was writing for national media. So, and I would do stories that would go out on the wires all over the country. And so they had to be, you know, there's a certain level of almost being conservative in a certain way, being so factual and kind of conservative that nobody could really argue with those stories. Like something like Lazar is way more out there, right? It creates all this controversy and look what he's claiming. You know, I would have never written about something like that, even though I was interested in it. I just stayed very much, you know, on the Cometa report. And the next one was on a report from a NASA, former NASA scientist about aviation safety issues involving UFOs. And then, you know, very kind of just data-driven, factual, conservative stories. So I never got flack from any of those stories. So George was, he was in a position to cover a lot more kind of controversial topics than I could, because the way I was positioning myself was, and I was working with a public relations firm in Washington, and I was really trying to get to the Congress, get to the policymakers with the kinds of stories that they could accept and relate to. So I had to be very careful about what I wrote about. And that was sort of my mission, you know, whereas George was in this Las Vegas station, and he wasn't out in the national media so much, and he could just play with more different things. He had the opportunity to do that. He was in a different kind of scenario than I was, with a different purpose, really. I think that was, but you know, I thought he was a great reporter, and I learned a lot from him. And I'm sure he had, but in some ways it was more fun to do what he was doing, to be able to cover Bob Lazar and have everybody, you know, talk about it. And it's so interesting. You don't really know what the answer is. But I was just sort of taking these drier kind of reports that were, you just couldn't argue with, but they, to me, they weren't really dry, because, you know, look what we're dealing with here. But anyway, so that I was really trying to make something, write something only that a member of Congress could have it on their desk and read it and not be at all like, oh, this is weird. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to affect that kind of person.
But now it seems like the story itself is now maybe backing you into the corner where you have to sort of now report on elements that sound like the Bob Lazar story, you know, the sort of things that the Gary Nolan is going public with, you know, the idea that these reverse engineering programs do exist. And these craft do exist. So how do you feel now that the story's moving into this area after all these years?
It's more interesting, but it's also harder to get stories into like large mainstream papers with that kind of a topic. So the challenges mount the further along we go, basically, for me as trying to report on things as they move. It's just more of a challenge because there's more resistance in the mainstream, you know, for those kinds of topics. But it's just, it has to happen. It's the direction we're going in. So yeah. I'm trying to make it happen in the way that I think is really credible, and, you know, try to bring it out in as good as well respected a venue as possible. So that it's not just something that bubbles around in the UFO community, but again, I'm still on that same path of wanting it to get into the mainstream. That's where it really matters. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just preach to the choir, right? If you just do.
Yes.
And it's a pretty crazy choir in a lot of ways.
Right.
Yeah. I have a question about how do you negotiate with, I mean, I guess the question is like, what's a bigger challenge for you? Is it, or what do you think is a bigger challenge to the conversation? Is it UFO Twitter? That sort of.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kind of semi-hysterical space, or is it government obstinacy? You know, like what? Because I do, you know, feel a sense of that we need books like this and journalism like this to you know, mature the conversation beyond just like everything's a conspiracy, everything is out there. I guess, what is your feeling about what's the greater hindrance at this point? Do you feel like government's kind of buckling, but then the conspiracies get all riled up and are creating this sort of pullback where people are like, well, it all can't all be true? I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, I don't I don't even go on Twitter, so I just stay away from the whole Twitter universe. And sometimes people will send me certain tweets or something like that that are relevant to me, but I don't spend time on it. So I just sort of know what it's like from what people have told me. Occasionally, I might have looked at it occasionally, but I'm not part of that world. But I think the challenge really is that there's so much, first of all, that everything that's important is classified. That's really difficult. Because if you want to write a story, let's say, about crash retrievals, like Dave just mentioned, or reverse engineering, you can never prove any of it because it's all classified. So the challenge is, that's a big part of it. And the fact that the people, so many of the people that are willing to talk about this will only talk off the record, right? So you can't print it. And then that the members of Congress know so much more than they're willing to say. So there's all this information out there, that in various ways that you can get access to, but you can't put it out in the media. And so that's so frustrating, because if you only could, it would change everything. So it's really, I think that's the challenge. You know that people know these things. So, and I think the members of Congress, even those who know, they're in no hurry for it to come out, right? It's like, let it take as long as we can is sort of the attitude, right? It's like, the resistance just sort of is baked in, and they're not jumping up and down to have it happen as soon. So you're kind of battling that resistance, and you're battling the fact that so much of it can't go on the record. And so how do you, if you're a reporter and you've talked to, 12 absolutely convincing people, and only two of them are going to go on the record, yet you know what all those other ones have said, but you can't even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know the story, but you can't write about it in a way that's convincing. That's, imagine how frustrating that is. That's kind of the situation I find myself in.
So not to put words in your mouth, but is it fair to characterize what you just said as that you believe these programs perhaps, or not perhaps, do exist, and you simply can't get enough people on the record to speak about them versus the question of do they exist?
I would say it's, as Gary Nolan said, that they exist. I mean, I have no doubt about that. There are programs, there are materials that are being held by those programs. They've been around for decades. There are enough people who have come forward privately about that, not just to me, but to Gary and a lot of other people, that and to the members of Congress, that we know that's the case at this point. So how do you get that in a story, with enough proof or documentation or corroboration or whatever, editors require? Just because you know it from talking to a lot of very highly credible people is not enough. So that's what the challenge is for a journalist. But I have no doubt that it's true. I have no doubt about that.
And it seems also, there's even a problem of getting that information from those sources and even from Congress Congress to Arrow. Like, it seems like that information isn't even making it to Arrow.
Or it's supposed to go from Arrow to Congress, really. And the question is that happening enough? And I'm not sure that it is, but a Congress has to really stay on top of it, because I'm not sure that, Arrow was supposed to be sending over transcripts and reports to Congress. And I think that, I don't really know, but it was sort of suggested to me, and around the time of the hearing, that maybe that was one reason why she had that hearing, to kind of move them along. So, there's that too. There's the communication that has to happen.
You feel like the information is more running from Congress to Arrow, or
because I think it's more the other way. I mean, I think the way it's set up, as I understand it, is that Arrow is supposed to report to Congress.
Mm-hmm. But Arrow,
I'm sure if Arrow wanted information from Congress, I'm assuming they could get it. But
isn't there a problem with that Kirkpatrick doesn't even have security clearances to look into some of the witness testimony that he's getting? He doesn't have the security clearances to investigate it?
I don't know. I know he has security clearances to hear classified testimony or classified report from people who come talk to him. He does have that. Mm-hmm. Whether he has clearances to follow up on certain leads, I don't know. I don't know how much he is following up on leads. I mean, that's the other question that people have. if he gets testimony, therefore they should be investigating and following up on it. Maybe they are. We wouldn't hear about it, you know?
Yeah.
We don't really, I don't think a lot of people know exactly what's going on inside of Arrow and what is being done and what's not being done. So that's, hopefully we'll find out more, but they should be following up. I mean, that was one of the things in his testimony at the hearing, that he didn't reference the fact that he has heard from people related to these programs. He didn't even mention the programs. You know, there's no evidence that anything's extraterrestrial. He said, well, the people who have been telling about the programs are providing that very evidence.
Yeah.
And he's not acting like that's never happened. Like, yes, he hasn't heard from these people.
Or saying there's
so
no,
it's kind of a,
yeah, no, no evidence, yeah, of some new physics. But if you look at even
the, but he's the, also saying, I think there's no evidence that they're extraterrestrials.
Yeah.
Right. He doesn't really think they are. There's some people who have been inside the program dealing with, you know, materials that are not made by humans. That's pretty good evidence.
Yeah.
And he's heard some of
that. Yeah.
He's heard some of that. Yeah. So maybe he doesn't consider evidence if it's just somebody reporting that to him.
So
I don't know, but
just, I'm sorry, go back just a second, because you know that he has heard that there is debris that people have studied and reverse engineered. So you just want to be clear, you know that.
Yeah. As far as I know, yes, that people have, I mean, I think a lot of them have gone to Congress, but they've gone to Arrow too. And they have spoken to maybe, you know, to staff there about their experiences with these programs and their knowledge of the programs. Yeah, that's all part of the process. And that's why the whistleblower protections were set up, because normally they couldn't even talk about these things. So now they can, and they're doing it.
You've created your own Cometa report here. I mean, it's it's like you've got everyone together, and then you put, there was one anecdote in this, which I just thought was kind of, I don't know, the validation of witness testimony, which is so dismissed by the debunkers so easily, the callous way that these convicted, you know, the conviction is just sort of swept aside, and that all the expertise of these witnesses are sort of so dismissed. But there was a moment that you have between the pilots who engaged the UFOs, one the Iranian pilot and one the pilot from Peru, who were never met, but you had brought together for this kind of committee. It was such a sort of human moment. Do you want to just describe what that was and what that kind of meant to you?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite moments. So it's interesting that you remember that of all the things in the book, because that really was. So so both those cases involved a pilot attempting to shoot down a UFO. In what the Iranian pilot felt he had to do it for self-defense, because there were these projectiles that were heading right for his plane, and he just thought they were going to hit his plane. So he locked onto them with his missiles, and when they got to a certain closeness to him, all his equipment went out and he couldn't fire the missiles. And that happened a few times, and luckily they never hit his plane, but that was his reason for doing it. And then the Peruvian pilot was actually instructed to go up and shoot down this thing that they thought was a spy balloon. And when he actually shot it, then he realized it was not a balloon. It was a UFO, by the way it behaved. So both, and there's a whole story with each case, and they both wrote their
amazing
own book. Yeah, I mean, they authored those chapters themselves. So you're really hearing directly from them. So it's really fascinating to me. But rather than go into all the details of the case, just to answer your question, in 2007, James Fox and I organized this press conference in Washington, in which we brought people from all over the world to come and speak. And both those pilots came. And so they met for the first time, the Peruvian Oscar Santa Maria and the Iranian, whose name was Parviz Jafari, who's now dead, unfortunately. But I remember being at this table when they were together for the first time talking about their incidents. And they were realizing that they were talking to the only other person in the world that we know of who had actually tried to shoot down a UFO. It was just something so profound about being able to witness that. I mean, it meant so much to them to meet each other. There was so much emotion in it, you know, for them to meet their counterpart and this very, very unusual thing that had happened to both of them. And for them to go over with each other what it was like and what they did and how the UFOs responded and how they felt. Oh, I just felt like I was privy to a very special moment at that. Yeah, it was really, really a great thing that they got to meet and that I was privileged enough to be there for that meeting. It was really, really great. Great.
I say, I'll put it for anyone, assuming that somebody does listen to this, they should see because a lot of that that panel that you guys set up was covered in James Fox's movie I Know What I Saw. I think that's the documentary where he covered sort of gathering all those people together and going to have this this meeting, which I guess was you were hoping that event would spawn more action within government. And more interest.
I was hoping, and of course it got a lot of media coverage for one or two days, and then it's just over and nothing happened. Exactly. Mm. I mean, I remember I had a group then called the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and I had a lot of support from John Podesta and Fife Symington and others, and we had this petition we wrote, and we had it on a big easel blown up, you know, at the conference, asking the government to take on, you know, the laying out all the reasons why they should investigate this and take it seriously. And it was signed by all these people, like the ones who came to talk at our press conference, and like Fife Symington and other people. And it was just like, yeah, I was just kind of lobbying for that, not knowing that that was the very year when the OSAP program was beginning to be set up, which was the precursor to ATIP, which I ended up reporting on in the Times. So, it was kind of an irony in that sense, but that was secret. So, yeah, I mean, the press conference was really, really wonderful. I encourage people. I mean, there should be a video just of that whole press conference somewhere on YouTube. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Where you can just sit and watch it for those who haven't. And they only talk for like 5 minutes each. It doesn't get boring at all, but it really isn't. It was an amazing group of people.
Yeah, I've watched the entire conference myself, amazing. And it's highly recommended. Also, I also recommend James Fox's movie about it, and also his previous movie, Out of the Blue, which I know for me was a movie that got me to take the subject more seriously, and also got me to take the history of the subject more seriously, because I didn't dive into the history of it really until that point. What? And again, he did the same thing you do in your book, which is this overwhelming number of credible people telling the same, basically the same story over and over again, that there's something real happening. And
it's effective, right?
Yeah, effective. Very effective. I mean, it certainly broke through my shell and got me to think about. And after watching that movie, I read your book pretty much right after that.
I also think
James has done a lot of great movies, The Phenomenon, and then this more recent one about the case in Roswell, Moment of Contact. He's really making a tremendous contribution, and he's a good friend of mine. So giving him a.
Well, I'm a huge fan of his and the work he's done. Yeah,
The Phenomenon was amazing. We were talking about the Brazil case that was recently he was talking about on Rogan, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about that. We were talking about it.
Well, yeah, there was the clip that James Fox put up on social media of you confirming that your sources were confirmed that the U.S. military was involved in the Virginia incident, that they were involved in moving materials out of Brazil.
And that the incident itself is happened just the way it's said to have happened. I mean, that's really shocking. Right? And he's working really hard to try to get a hold of the videos and the photographs and all the data that's out there that we don't have yet. I think it's just a matter of time before he's going to have that data. And that'll be interesting.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, the Virginia incident was a crashed UFO in Virginia, Brazil. And that involved two bodies, one that was actually one that was live, and one that was recovered by a police officer who then suffered severe medical complications as a result of being exposed to it. And I guess
died.
Died from it. Yeah. that.
Well, who confirmed this to you? I want to know who confirmed, you know. I know you won't be able to tell us who confirmed it.
There's been a fair amount of confirmation on that case. Absolutely. I mean, the doctors, I've talked to them myself who worked on that guy who died. I mean, there's the circumstances of a death really. He had this little cut on his shoulder from having grabbed this entity when it was alive, and it cut him, and he got a horrific infection. And no antibiotics would work. This one guy who I spoke to was really old. I think he's done autopsies. He's like famous in Brazil. He said he'd never ever seen anything like that, and he attributed it to him grabbing the creature. For somebody to get an infection that severe and die that quickly.
And they were never able to determine the nature of the infection, were they?
Well, they were able to determine what organisms in his body. Yeah. And that's interesting, too. I mean, and I'm trying to learn more about that. And actually, Gary Nolan, I hope, is going to help us try to understand all of that. But one of the organisms is something that is normally only found on animals. It's not, you know, which is kind of interesting because maybe that would be found on a UFO alien walking around. I don't know. But it's not normal that it would be found in a human body in connection with a severe infection like this. Let's put it that way. Nothing about it was normal. But, you know, we don't have enough records, but we do have one autopsy report on the individual who died. So there's a lot of interesting stuff.
And the witnesses you spoke to in regards to this case, they stand up the way the witnesses in this, in other words, they sort of pass your journalistic kind of level of credibility in their stories, or the or is it people in government?
James has talked to lots of military people in Britain. Yeah, I haven't. I just got interested in the autopsy reports, and so I've talked to some of the doctors, but those are the only people I've talked to. James is, you know, you guys might have a great time if you had James on the show.
Well, we'd love to.
He knows that. He's been working on it for 10 years. Talk to everybody in the country, and it's just a fascinating story to hear him talk about.
Well, believe me,
I'm absolutely peripheral.
I was going to say, believe me, when we're done here, I will be pressing you to help us hook up with James.
I'm curious.
We'd be glad to do it.
In terms of to pivot for a moment, because your Surviving Death is such an interesting book, story, documentary, and I'm wondering if there's nothing in here about like abduction, for example, but
right.
Mike, I guess we've talked a little bit about how some of these topics can dovetail and swerve into each other a little bit, and I was wondering initially what drew you to this topic, which I suppose there's similarities because you're reliant on eyewitness testimony and what you can confirm. And again, I don't want to try to put words in your mouth, but what drew you to this subject matter? Were there any similarities, anything from the UFO topic that drew you to it, or was it just a completely separate interest of yours? And then maybe we can later sort of talk a little bit about the abduction phenomenon.
Okay. I would say so the book is called Surviving Death, and it's really dealing with the question of what is the best evidence for the possibility that consciousness survives death. And that's a question I had been interested in for years. And I had sort of explored it while I was doing reporting on UFOs. And I'd gotten involved with some people making documentaries on it. I met some of the people and, you know, had a real interest in some of the reincarnation cases that were coming out of the University of Virginia. But I never saw it as having anything to do with UFOs. I always thought of it as something completely separate. And the same thing when I wrote the book. You know, I had written my other book in 2010, and then there was a documentary made for History Channel based on my book, and that was in 2011. And then I was just kind of ready to do something else. And my publisher actually invited me, said, is there something else you want to write a book about? And I had literally been thinking at that very time about doing a book regarding this question of survival past death. So I just jumped into that, it was really a journey for me to go on, because I hadn't already done it. You know, it was like I knew some of the things I would write about. I had an outline, but it was much more of an unknown process for me than writing the UFO book was, because I'd already done all that work. So anyway, I jumped in. To answer your question, I never thought of it as being connected to UFOs. And it was only after, years after that, I guess it came out in 2017, early, you know, before the New York Times. So it's been since then that I've learned more about the connection. And I've learned that a lot of people do consider, people I respect, really great thinkers in this field, do consider there to be a connection between consciousness, between the afterlife, between, you know, paranormal abilities and all the things that I've written about in that book to the UFO phenomenon. And so I'm much more open now to seeing them as one kind of universe of thing. But when I was doing the book, I was not at all in that space. So it's kind of an interesting evolution that I've been through after writing the book. So there's nothing in that book that would ever suggest any connection, because I wasn't aware of it then. And it was also journalistic. I mean, I was really trying to just take the studies and the evidence that was out there in a lot of different areas that point towards this reality of survival, and kind of writing them in a journalistic way and providing evidence, but in an interesting way. And just like my UFO book, I invited individuals to write their own chapters in it. You know, so it was a little more, it wasn't quite as hardcore as the UFO book. It was a little more personal and exploratory, and you're dealing with much weirder stuff. Then you know, UFOs, at least in my original book on UFOs, it was really about data for a physical object in the sky, right? Mm-hmm. But with surviving death, I'm dealing with all kinds of weirder phenomena, like poltergeists and mediumship and, you know, paranormal levitations and, near-death experiences, reincarnation cases. You know, it's a little more out there than UFOs. Ironically, but it's true.
Do you think maybe just the fact that you're able at some point in your life to get around that barrier to taking UFOs seriously? Do you think that same, opening of the mind, did that maybe lead to taking this subject more seriously and applying a journalistic rigor to it?
Yeah, because I think there are two big questions that I've always been interested in. You know, are we alone in the universe? And what happens when we die? They're both like big human questions, right? Mm. So yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of, I've always had this kind of probing curiosity about these bigger questions. And this one was just as important to me as UFOs, or are we alone, right? Mm-hmm. And by the time, I was really ready to explore something else at that point. I mean, I had been so fixated on UFOs for so long. Yeah. I mean, the book was out. I felt like, what more do I have to say? It's all in my book.
Yeah.
And right?
Oddly, it's the subject that, the other subject that Robert Bigelow is pumping a lot of money into.
Right now. Exactly. That's his primary interest. And he went from UFOs to that. Although I think he was interested in that actually previously when he was involved with NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, but he never officially, they didn't take it on, but he's always been interested in it. And then he set up this institute. And I worked at that institute for over a year, maybe a year and a half, on this initial project that they did a couple of years ago. So, that was after my book came. And I've had a lot of time swimming in the waters of the whole survival question and all the people that are engaged with that question. And then trying to see how that connects with UFOs. It's really interesting. And there are people that think about that a lot more than I do. There are great thinkers like Jeffrey Kripal from Rice University. And Whitley Strieber is another one who write a lot about the interconnections. Colm Kelleher is another one, who reported on the Skinwalker Ranch incidences. These are people who have thought a lot about these connections and have talked and written about it. So I learned a lot from them.
I'm curious if any of the witnesses that saw these discs, did they ever offer up anything that seemed maybe outside of the able to prove through data thing? And I speak of like abduction. A lot of times people who are witnesses have, you know, additional experiences that are harder to quantify, harder to, I'm just wondering if you ever had to leave out any information that went outside of what you were trying to kind of journalistically provide provable through other sources, et cetera.
I would say the answer to that is yes. I mean, because there, you know, if I had brought that kind of stuff in at the time that I was working in 2010, say, when I wrote my book, it would not have worked out. It just couldn't have had the impact that I was looking for. And so, you know, there are military witnesses, just like anybody else, who have experiences and they get affected by these encounters in ways that they're not necessarily going to want to talk about. That's even more taboo than just reporting on seeing an object, right? Yeah. So, yeah, there are plenty of them. And I think, you know, more and more now they're more comfortable talking about it, but there's still a huge stigma against that level of engagement with UFOs, as we all know. And I hope that that changes. And I think that our government, by putting in the NDAA, that they want reports on medical effects. I mean, I don't know if you noticed that, but that's in the language of the legislation, that they want reports on people that have had medical effects from these encounters. And medical effects are one of the things that happen to people who have these strange experiences, you know, it sort of opens the door to the whole, I don't know just about abduction, but the whole experience or realm of UFO studies. So, you know, hopefully mental effects, you know, I think psychological effects is in there as well. That's what that's all about.
Yeah.
It's conscious effects on people.
And there's also the notion that people who have had a UFO experience often have other, what, for lack of a better term, paranormal experiences that start occurring after they've had a UFO encounter, that they suddenly encounter other things that don't seem right. I mean, Colm Kelleher and George wrote about it in their Skinwalkers at the Pentagon. The people who are exposed to events at Skinwalker Ranch suddenly have weird, really bizarre things happening in their lives after that.
Same thing with a UFO sighting. You can have a UFO sighting and then have weird things happen in your life. Or you have paranormal abilities that you didn't have before. You start having clairvoyant dreams, you know, dreams that predict the future, or clairvoyant abilities, or telepathic abilities. You know, something in your brain is like switched open. And nobody really understands that, but it affects consciousness. And then the question is, well, does consciousness affect the UFO? Is that part of what determines your experience? These are the kinds of questions that are so interesting to think about. We don't know the answers, you know, but there's a component of consciousness that plays a big role. And so consciousness is what I was really exploring in my book, Surviving Death, not as it pertains to UFOs, but as it pertains to all these interesting abilities that people have. And the fact that consciousness can operate separate from the brain. And so then you can just put it all together into one huge mystery, you know, and they all seem to dwell in the same type of mysterious realm. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's another dimension where the UFOs dwell, and so do the people who die and go somewhere else. I mean, we don't know.
Was there in Surviving Death with the children that are experiencing a past life or have this sort of uncanny evidence or, you know, information, you know, the recipe for napalm or whatever else kind of wild, traceable pieces of evidence? Was there ever anything that in your mind kind of unified those stories? Was there any experience that tied them together? I'm reaching because I don't know the answer, but was there anything that you found similar to their backgrounds, upbringings, birth, anything that could suggest some?
Well, that's interesting because, and I have to again rely on the research of the University of West of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies there, where they've asked all those questions and they've done studies. And basically, I mean, it appears that there is no unifying factor in terms of walk of life or race or religion or birth or anything like that. But the one interesting thing is that the majority of the cases in which children remember these past lives, their previous life involved a violent and premature death, an unnatural death, you know, like being in a war or being murdered or crashing in a plane or something really traumatic. And so it leaves you with the feeling that maybe because of that, there was something unresolved for them. I think it's something like 75% of them involve children who had a violent premature death in a previous life, an unnatural death, which is really interesting. Now, the two cases I wrote about, only one of them, the second case of Ryan Hammonds, didn't involve the guy was in his 60s, but he just got ill and died. It wasn't like that. But the majority of them are, and I think there are more boys than girls also, because boys tend to have violent deaths more than girls. Hmm. So that's I think it was one of the few unifying factors they were able to really put their finger on when they looked at all the cases and, you know, did all this data analysis to see what common threads they could find. And then the other thing, of course, is that in cultures which believe in this and are open to it, they're going to get a lot more reports. Right. Than they get from cultures that aren't. So people think, oh, it happens more in India or, you know, in Sri Lanka or somewhere. But I don't know if that's true. It's just that those countries feel free to report on them and talk about them. So a lot of the data that they've gotten on these cases comes from those countries.
I'm sure a number of the incidents.
But really, it's interesting. Violent deaths. Huh?
No, I was just going to say, I'm sure if there there incidents in our culture would just be treated and cured. rather than listen to.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. And the children often have kind of traumatic, they do often have these horrific nightmares about the previous death, which is often a very unpleasant death, a sudden, scary, you know. But yeah, so it's an interesting question. It seems to happen to just, it's unpredictable who it's going to happen to and where and why, and except for this one element.
Yeah. Well, I definitely know reading your book made me as a lifelong atheist, or almost lifelong, going back at least to about the age of six. It made me less complacent about my notions about whether or not there's any kind of persistence to this to our minds. So definitely made me less closed to the subject, I would say.
Well, that's cool. I mean, I don't think atheism is in contradiction to that either, because I'm not talking about God.
No.
I'm not talking about a belief in any deity or anything. I'm just talking about, and there are studies that show that consciousness can function separate from the body when the person's alive. So the question is, does that happen when they die? And if it does, it doesn't mean you can't be an atheist and still accept it.
Yeah, no, I think
I don't see a.
Yeah, well, I think I'll stick with not believing or particularly even liking God. If there is one.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah, but I'm definitely open to the idea that there is perhaps some kind of persistence of consciousness and of self, I guess.
Right. And that doesn't have to have anything to do with God.
No, it could just be part of the natural sciences that we don't understand yet.
Now, in your journeys in your journeys and travels and discussions and hearing all of this testimony and witnesses, have you reached a personal conclusion about what you think UAPs are? Is that as I understand, as a journalist, you're not way. I'm just curious if you have if you feel like these are outer space visitors or. As it gets into the sort of weirder department of something that's sort of parallel to us, as we discuss kind of entities and other side and near death and the kind of ubiquity of experience, I'm just wondering if you're leaning one way or another.
Well, I certainly don't see it as being as simple as visitors from some other planet, which is more when I started, like even in my book, everybody was saying, oh, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. That's what the French people said in the Cometa report. Extraterrestrial hypothesis was sort of the going explanation, sure. Which meant visitors from another universe, another solar system or whatever. But I don't think anybody really looks at it that simply anymore, you know, because there's so much more that's been learned about the sort of high strangeness elements of it. And there's so much more data that it doesn't always seem feasible that it's that simple. I can't say that I really have any kind of conclusion about what I think it is. It's just something way more complicated than just somebody getting in a ship and flying here, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be that these aliens have been, if you want to use the word aliens or whatever they might be, this non-human intelligence is a mm-hmm. term that's being used a lot now, that whatever that is could have been here before on the planet Earth before we even got here. Yeah. They could be coming from under the oceans or, you know, another dimension, and we, you know, any place. We just don't know.
Is there anything?
But I think they've been around a long time.
Is there anything you really hope it isn't?
I hope it isn't something that's malevolent and wants to get rid of us. We kind of deserve it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's keep it positive. Let's, you know, let's put in some good, you know, some good cheer for humanity. We don't have to.
That's what, of course, I hope that, and it would be great if whatever it is was able to teach us and share things with us, right, that could help us improve life on this planet. But we're not doing a very good job so far of showing that we're worthy of that, I don't think.
Yeah.
So they might, you know, if they wanted to remove all of these humans from the planet Earth and start over, I could understand why.
And it doesn't.
If they have that capacity, I have no idea.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like, well, it certainly doesn't seem like we have any capacity to defend against them if they do have that capability and that desire.
Right. I would assume that's true. And yeah.
They definitely show the attitude, every description, they show the attitude of someone dealing with a crazy person. You know, it's just like, okay, well, let's keep a certain distance. Let's like, look, don't engage, don't piss them off. Don't, you know, don't do anything. Just no sudden movements, just kind of. So there is a little bit of a kind of asylum approach to, you know, then they seem, whoever they are, very far, you know, not wanting to overly engage, which, you know, I guess makes sense, which sort of fits with the hypothesis.
It does, because they probably try to shoot them down or something. We're mm-hmm. so hostile and militarily focused. I mean, I don't know. But of course, the experiencers will tell you they have very close up personal experiences with them. And the problem is there's no data to prove that. It's just somebody telling you that. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's always sort of has this nebulousness about it. It's always not quite concrete enough for us to put our fingers on, like you were just describing. And that's the nature of it. You know, it's never quite there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, imagine if the potential that it would have if it wanted to. I assume it could just land vehicles all over the planet if it wanted to, right?
Yeah.
Make itself known 100%. And it's not doing that.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll happen at some point. Maybe phenomenon itself will be what creates our what we call disclosure, you know. Maybe it will manifest in such a way indisputable. But so far, that doesn't seem to be the agenda. Mm. So,
well, it does seem like even now
we have no control over it.
Yeah,
we have no control, so anything's possible.
And if we do get the disclosure everyone's asking for, I think there's a good chance that there'll be a little bit of disappointment to realize that the main thing that's going to be disclosed is how little we know or understand about what's going on.
Could be, yeah.
And what would be the next shoe to drop in that would in if we're keeping with this in sense of encouragement, the sense of that, which I think is valid, and I agree with you. I think there's more movement publicly than I've seen in my life, and like I said, thanks to the work that you've done and Chris Mellon and all your colleagues,
it is so encouraging that you're still optimistic.
Yeah, I know. It's like I'm happy to hear it. So in to follow that encouragement, what would you like to expect to hope to see in 6 months to a year? Is there any sense of in your mind of what that could be, beyond just sheer prediction?
Yeah, I mean, I think the aspect that's really sort of on the radar right now is the whistleblowers, not just whistleblowers, but witnesses coming forward and providing information to Congress. So that has potential. If some of that is made public, you know, that has potential to really shift things a lot. If the information that they provide is somehow being made public, the parts of it, it is mainly classified information, but, you know, somehow some of that could come out, or just sort of generalities about what they're saying could come out. There could be another hearing. There's already talk of Tim Burchett is talking about wanting to do a hearing. Maybe there'll be a hearing in which some of these actual whistleblowers or witnesses are brought forward. It won't just be government officials who are testifying, but it might be people with actual firsthand information that can come forward. I mean, that could happen. So I think, you know, that's sort of what's the next level, I think, is something that's going to come out of all these people who are coming forward and who had the permission to come forward now because of legislation that's been passed and the kind of umbrella that Congress is providing for them to do that. And it's just a question of how much of that will be made public, you right. know, and can we nudge that forward? And that's, and if it, if some of it is, you know, maybe some of those people will just come out independently from the, from what they've provided to Congress. I think there's a lot of them that want this information to come out. So we can't really predict what they might do in the next year, but that's sort of where I think the real juice lies right now. And the real potential for the next step is the fact that they are now able to talk to Congress and to Arrow, and that they're doing it. And where is that information going to go? How much are we going to learn about that? And there's a lot of motivation among certain Congress to bring this out and to have more hearings and to try to bring it out into the open. So let's see. Hopefully that's going to happen over the next year. That's sort of how I see it. That's where I'm focused, you know, sort of really paying attention to what's going on there at that, in that universe.
Well, I hope that's the case. And I feel pretty sure you'll be part of a big part of that nudging in the work you're doing.
I try to be. It's hard for a freelancer to get stories, you know, articles published, but yeah. I'm working on that. Yeah. yeah. And I'm just in touch with a lot of people and trying to help bring things out. So we'll just have to see what happens, what I can do. But there's a lot of people working on it. It's unbelievable how many people are working behind the scenes and in public, too, that are just making such a difference.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly recommend everyone reads your book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials. Go on the Record, a title I can never remember if I don't have to read it. So there, but it's a great title. Recommend people read that, and your series that you did for Nat Geo. I think UFOs exploring the unexplained.
I was just going to mention that it's called UFOs Investigating the Unknown. Actually, made that for CNN. It was made with a company called Breakthrough Films, who also made Surviving Death on Netflix. They're a really good film company, and I had a big role in this National Geographic one. It was made for CNN, and then CNN tanked over the summer. They just dropped their whole documentary film department because they were bought up in a merger. It was a disaster, and we thought we were going to lose the film completely because it had already been delivered to them. But fortunately, Nat Geo got it. Yeah, Nat Geo aired it, and then they put it on Hulu. So I think they did a great job. I think it's a really good kind of, if you just want to get the basics about UFOs in a really entertaining, enjoyable way, I'd really recommend watching the series. And
this guy recommended it to me, and it's fabulous. Yeah. And my wife and I were talking about it for days, and it's very, it really is. It does speak to the audience. We hope to bring, like, be a bridge. We're not, you know, we don't claim to be experts of it. We are super curious about it. We think everyone should know what's going on. And the more that, you know, we can just spread the word and lead people toward this kind of really data-driven, super credible information, I think will just hopefully help make it just continue
the series, just so people know, it's streaming on Hulu.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes.
That's where you have to go to watch it. You can get a free 30-day trial on Hulu, so you don't have to pay anything if you just do that and then cancel it.
Even better.
Or you can watch Hulu with commercials if you want. People can do that too. You can
at the $50 tier or whatever the tier, you know, the various tiers now that we have to kind of deal with.
But it's actually made with commercials.
Yeah.
Yeah, but get on the higher level where you don't have to listen to the commercials. I hate commercials, but. Yeah. Yeah, so I would just really, I think, I mean, I've heard from so many people, you who just have been really affected by that series, and I've heard so much good feedback. So
it's a great resource.
I would, you know, I just hope people.
Me too, and again, I guess we'll thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today.
And I am so, it was great to speak with you. Thank you so much. We would love to do this again at some point. There's so much to talk about as shoes drop or don't drop as we move forward. We'll need your advice and counsel and expertise on this. But thank you for the work that you've done on this, because I think it's been just seismic and has really, even with something like the group of witnesses brought together where seemed like there was a lot of attention and then it seemed to not lead to anything. I think that's incorrect. It's clearly just created this sort of building wave and building change and building psychological change in the public. It's all to your credit. So I think it's, you know, it's a real service.
Well, thank you very much. I've done the best I could do. I know it's helped. So, but I also have to also acknowledge so many other people who have contributed. So it's been, and more people are coming on board now since 2017. It's just magnified, so many more people involved. So, yeah. So I appreciate that you guys had me on. I wish you all the best with your podcast, and I hope you develop it and get whatever you want to do happens for you.
Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thank you. Thanks, yeah. Leslie.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I hope we'll see you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.